This evening we begin an exploration of the 13th chapter of Hebrews that should last for seven messages or so. We are continuing to look at the last significant places in the New Testament from which I have not preached or taught verse by verse. After our time in this chapter, we have several passages unique to Matthew to consider that were not covered in our various series from the Gospels. And that should about do it. As we think about taking up only this last chapter of Hebrews, it must be admitted that there will still be a chapter here and there in this book that has not been covered. We have never gone straight through this book of Hebrews. But I have preached or taught on many portions of it as a part of other series or in standalone messages. That would include chapters 3 through 7, chapters 11 and 12. We had the series through the Hall of Faith chapter not too long ago. It did not make sense to me to try to preach the unaddressed passages before chapter 13 to, you know, take chapter 1 and then, you know, maybe, you know, chapter 9 or whatever. And that didn't seem to be a good idea. But with this last chapter, there is a definite turning to specific practical matters that I think makes it profitable to take on its own. In this way, Hebrews follows the pattern of many of the letters in the New Testament. Foundational truths come first. Understanding our identity, understanding the gospel, understanding our salvation, understanding who Christ is. And then instruction comes on living out those fundamental truths. Well, doctrine doesn't get much heavier than the preceding chapters of this book. The Jews have been exhorted to leave behind the idea of keeping the law as a means of justification before God. They're to trust completely in the Messiah who fulfills the roles and rituals of the Mosaic system. But if we do have the Messiah as our salvation, if you are one of the believing Hebrews and beyond them, any believer, what does life in him look like? And that's what he turns to in chapter 13. The theme of this chapter is that Christ will be seen in our love for the brethren. What a very John-like emphasis. We've just been through 2nd and 3rd John, and we're in 1st John, however many years ago it was that I said. And that is huge with him, that love for the brethren is one of the identifying factors of anybody who has been regenerated. And I've taken the various aspects of loving the brethren in these verses as my organizing principle for this series. We will be considering how we love the brethren with our purity, our money, our submission to authority, our humiliation, our sacrifices, and our prayers. Wow. You know, that sounds rather serious. That sounds maybe a little intimidating. This is not the top 10 list of things that people want to get into as far as their personal lives and their behavior and so forth. But that is what we're going to do. Tonight, however, we begin with a subject that has been emphasized quite a bit to us by the Lord lately, and that's hospitality. Hospitality. And this will need to be a standalone message as we begin a standalone chapter. We will not be returning to Hebrews 13 until 4 weeks from tonight. As I was saying, you know, we don't have evening service for the next two Sundays, and then the one after that is our prayer service. So we won't have a preaching service again until 4 weeks from tonight. That is not ideal, you know, as a pastor looks at a series, that you preach the first message of it and then you don't have another one for that long. But that is what the schedule dictated. I thought that this could be a standalone message as we get into this chapter. So let's give our attention to these three verses. We begin with hospitality to the brethren, which is the overall heading of verse 1. Let love of the brethren continue. Just a note on the authorship of Hebrews, because I'm going to have to refer to the author as I go through these messages. I do not know who wrote this book. I do not have a strong opinion about who wrote this book. Some are sure that Paul wrote Hebrews. Some are equally sure that he did not. I lean against Pauline authorship, but I have no passion for the issue. So I'll be saying the author whenever I refer to the writer of this book. When we look at the last portion of chapter 12, if we want to look a little bit at context, the last portion of chapter 12 that precedes our verses, it can seem that there's a very abrupt change of theme between what we have as chapter 12 and then what we have as chapter 13. We have words of warning about the price of refusing to heed God's words about the preeminence of Christ. Our attention is directed to the awesome nature of God, who is a consuming fire to those who will not listen. And then suddenly we're loving the brethren. But the author is picking up on ideas introduced back in chapter 12, verse 14. Why don't we read Hebrews 12, 14? Pursue peace with all men, and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. I understand this seeing of the Lord to be what other people see in us, not our own seeing of the Lord in the future. Okay, it's not saying act a certain way or you won't see the Lord, you know, in the future. You're not a believer or something like that. He's saying it's through our sanctification process that other people see the Lord's life in us. As we live those holy lives, other people observe the Lord. His life is being displayed in our actions. Then in 12:28, we are to show gratitude for the inheritance of the kingdom that we've received by offering to God acceptable service. So 12:28 talks about our acceptable service. So as we head into chapter 13, we're seeing what that sanctified and sacrificial life will look like. Foremost in our service to God is the way that we treat others. So in this way, the two greatest commandments are fulfilled. We love the Lord our God with our heart, mind, soul, strength, and we love our neighbor as ourself. And we do the first by doing the second. Verse 1 literally reads, the brotherly love, let it remain. The brotherly love, let it remain. So we immediately note that this love that the author is talking about has been operative among these readers. They have been loving the brethren. And as both Paul and John make clear, that love is natural. It is inevitable in a Christian. It'd be very odd for Paul to talk to people who've been regenerate for some time and say, hey, you need to start loving the brethren. Because that is something, that's part of the new heart that we are given, to love others who are in the family of God. The world does not naturally love followers of Christ. In fact, very much the opposite. But regenerate people do naturally love other followers of the Lord. However, there is yet a need for a command to continue in this love. 1 Peter chapter 1. I'd like you to turn there. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 22 and 23 captures, I think, the essence of what we're getting into here very well. The idea of this is a given. This is going to be true if you're regenerate. But also the idea of a command to love the brethren. 1 Peter 1, 22 and 23. Since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. For you have been born again, not of seed which is perishable, but imperishable, that is, through the living and enduring word of God. Do you see what Peter does there? It's very similar to what the other New Testament writers do. He's clearly tying being born again, that's being regenerated by the Holy Spirit, being given spiritual life, with being purified for a sincere love of the brethren. Since this has happened, you have been purified by the Spirit for a sincere love of the brethren. That is natural. That is going to happen. It's a given. But still, both here and in Hebrews and other places, we're exhorted to love one another. Paul, he was the one who told us that we do not need to be taught to love one another. The God who is within us teaches us and makes it very clear and enables us and inspires us to love one another. We don't need to be taught that. Nobody has to come to somebody who has believed in the gospel, who now has Christ as his or her Lord, and say, you know what? You really need to love other people who are followers of Christ. They know that from the heart that they have been given by the Lord. So our love for one another will be seen. But we are to be intentional and fervent about it. As Peter says, well, okay, you've been purified for this. This is true, this about you. Now fervently love one another from the heart. We make it a priority to draw out of our souls that love that God has implanted there. We nurture that garden, as it were, rather than neglect it. If we forsake the assembly of the saints, for instance, and that's something that the author warns about a couple chapters back in chapter 10, don't do that, he says, and we looked at that in our leadership time this past Saturday. If we do forsake the assembly, well, then that love that God has put in us will not have any opportunity to be seen. Of course, with some, it is the desire to remain ignorant about the needs of the body that leads them to stay on the periphery, to be kind of scarce. The author obviously has hospitality in the forefront of his thinking here about love among the brethren because of where he goes with this in the next couple of verses. He's promoting various aspects of hospitality that should come to mind. The hosting of meetings, the providing of meals when that's needed, making one's possessions available, giving comfort. When we're staying out of the loop, not meeting with the brethren, we don't come into contact with those possibilities for loving the brethren. And sometimes that's why, people kind of stay at a distance. And then you hear, that person was in the hospital, you know, for 2 weeks or whatever. I didn't know. I'm sure I would have done something, you know, if I'd have known about that. Well, it was talked about at the last three meetings of the brethren when you weren't there. And for those who, on the other hand, have been in the trenches of showing hospitality for years and years and years, you don't forsake the assembly, and the responsibility of that can be very wearying. But we read here, we are to let that love abide. Let it remain. Let it continue. Don't grow weary in well-doing. Allow that love to keep showing itself. That love that is there, allow it to keep showing itself. That's really Christ in you. Allow him to keep showing himself in the specific deeds. And he's going to go on to talk about various things throughout this chapter, but certainly in the next couple of verses. So the author moves from that general exhortation, let love of the brethren continue, and that's kind of the head of the whole chapter, but we move now into a more specific command in verse 2, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. So we read here, we are to show hospitality to strangers. Now, at this point, I must make some comments on the Greek word for hospitality. This might seem a little technical, but I would not get into this if I did not feel that it was necessary to understand what's being said here. Reading this in English, we might suppose that there is a verb for showing hospitality, and then there is a noun for strangers. Okay? Show hospitality, one word, you know, to strangers, another word, and he put in the noun for strangers, and it's separate from the verb. That's what we would think just from reading this. And then we would think, well, if he were to talk about showing hospitality to a friend, let's say, to a fellow believer, well, he would use this verb hospitality, and then he would use another noun and say, you know, use the word for friend or fellow saint or something like that. And we would think, well, since it says hospitality to strangers, he used, you know, the noun for strangers, and it qualifies what kind of hospitality he's talking about. Well, the reason I'm saying all this is that is not the case, okay? There are not two different words here. This phrase, show hospitality to strangers, is translating a single verb. And that verb is made up of two words. It's the word for love and the word for strangers. Compound word, a stranger, you know, lover, loving strangers. The hospitable person in that sense, literally in the Greek, is someone who loves strangers. The point I'm making is that the verb for any kind of hospitality already has the word strangers in it. Any kind of hospitality. This verb is used elsewhere in Scripture, and it's translated simply hospitality with no reference to strangers, because the word just meant being hospitable. It didn't necessarily mean that it was to strangers. Okay? Are you following what I'm saying? Okay. This is just the word for hospitality of any kind, even though it has the word strangers in it. It's in fact this verb that we have right here is used in other contexts where it's just translated hospitality, and it's talking about two fellow believers. Okay? That's the context. Another verb for hospitality is used in 1 Timothy chapter 5 in regard to widows who can be put on the list for church support, and it gives some qualifications that they have to meet in order to be put on this list, and one of them is that they must have shown hospitality to strangers. That's a different word. It's only used one time. There we have a compound verb that has strangers and the word for receive or welcome in it. They must have been somebody who was a stranger welcomer, a stranger receiver. Since I do not have any other examples of that verb, I do not know whether it was also used just generally for hospitality or not, no matter who was in view. So, why did the translators choose to add to strangers here when they could have just said, do not neglect to show hospitality? But they chose, in this specific case, to add to strangers, even though it doesn't necessarily mean that in every situation. Why did they do that? I would assume it is because of the added note of the angels and the reference to Abraham entertaining people that he did not recognize. They were not familiar to him. Since they were strangers to Abraham, the translators went ahead and figured that the writer meant strangers when he used this verb. Well, I don't have a problem with that. I'm not saying that I have a problem with the fact that they put in the idea of two strangers here. I think we are meant to show hospitality to strangers. I think that's a biblical idea. The parable of the Good Samaritan certainly demonstrates that. Show hospitality to strangers. And I titled my point this way. So I'm not against that. But you need to be aware that the author is not excluding believers. He's not excluding people that we know by his choice of words here. This is still part of letting love for the brethren remain. It's interesting that the author commands that we be not forgetful of hospitality. Another way of the understanding this word for neglect. Neglect it, be forgetful of it. Because that highlights a tendency of the flesh. Probably none of us is opposed to the idea of hospitality. I don't think anybody here is against it. We certainly like to receive it. We like to think that we would be hospitable if it came down to it. Probably very few people are willing to just flat out say, I'm not a hospitable person. But do we neglect it? This is one of those things where it can suddenly occur to us that we have not extended ourselves in hospitality for a long time. It's really been a long time since I really made an overtly hospitable gesture towards someone, especially maybe somebody who is not close to me. When was the last time that you had someone other than family into your home, for a meal, refreshments, whatever. When was the last time you hosted a missionary or took a struggling Christian worker out for a meal? Have we grown forgetful about the need for hospitality? Have we neglected it? The example given for our encouragement is the one where the angel of the Lord and two holy angels visited Abraham and Sarah. Abraham was ignorant at first of the identity of these three male figures, but that did not keep him from offering the best that he had on the spur of the moment. And we were just looking at what Gideon went and did and brought for the offering to the Lord. And when you read what Abraham and Sarah prepared for the three visitors, it's really monumental generosity that goes on there. And I'm very sure that as that situation developed and he came to realize more and more what was actually going on here, I'm sure he was glad that he had not told them, hey, you know, take a drink from the trough if you want to and then be on your way. Now, that would have been, you know, quite a fail. That would be a big miss. So what's the author's point here? By bringing up that situation, alluding to it. Is it that angels are always disguising themselves and interacting with humans? So we'd better be on our toes. You just never know. That could be an angel. Should we, you know, think about all the times that we just might have given an angel directions? Helped an angel with a flat tire. Maybe the girl to whom I gave a cookie in the elementary school lunchroom was actually an angel. I don't think so. I don't think that there is anything like that event in that we see in Genesis and in the whole rest of the Bible. So what's the point? I'm just doing that because often the kind of fleshly tendency is to get stuck on the idea of, ooh, there might be angels among us. I'm not saying that there aren't. I'm just saying that that's not the point. The point is that we do not know why a given person has been sent by God into our path. We do not know what eternal benefit might come of showing hospitality to someone that we don't know. God uses our sacrifices along these lines for spiritual good. So don't sell any situation short. That's what the author is saying. What forms can our own hospitality to strangers take? To one degree or another, such things as providing food for the Community Hope Center, or supplies for Options Now / Arms of Love, helping to serve food at soup kitchens, supporting a child in need through the many agencies that do that kind of work. All of that, I think, applies here. Certainly inviting a visitor to the church, inviting such a person over to your home after the service, being prepared to do such a thing, or taking them out after the service would apply here. Many churches do that as a matter of course. Okay. They tend to be ones that have a few more visitors than we do. But they're prepared to get with somebody, invite them, and so forth, when they come to a service. There is perhaps not as critical a need to look out for the physical needs of others in our place and time as in the day of this epistle. But people are looking for a sense of connectedness to others in our transitory world. They're not finding it. What can we do to help those who are looking for help, looking for a friend, wondering if there's someone who will be concerned about them? As always, we add that we do need to use some common sense here. We protect those for whom we're responsible from harm. We don't invite a stranger to come in and sleep next to our children. Not in this day and age anyway, if that was ever true. But we are not to neglect legitimate opportunities because of selfish reasons either. And I think that that is the more common behavior. We're more prone to neglect than to go too far in seeking to help those in need. Lastly, we have hospitality to prisoners in verse 3. Remember the prisoners as though in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves also are in the body. Again, the command is to keep such people in mind. The tendency is to keep those who are in such straits well off of the radar screen. It's uncomfortable. We're rather to make it a point to think about them. And what's more, to identify with them. Identify with them. The author seems to be speaking particularly of those who were in prison for the sake of Christ. We have many instances of this in the New Testament. In addition, many were suffering the loss of their possessions as a result of standing for the faith. The author here had already recognized the demonstrated concern of some in these matters in chapter 10, verse 34. Hebrews 10:34, "For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one." So there were various levels of persecution being endured here. Some, you know, believers were being thrown in prison. Some were losing their belongings. Believers were to consider the right response in each case. Timothy had just been released from bonds, as we heard read in verse 23. Paul had exhorted that young man to endure hardship with him, you know, as a good fellow soldier and so forth in 2 Timothy, and it's clear that Timothy had done so. The larger body needed to be ready to help him with whatever needs he might have. He probably didn't have anything. The author was hoping that Timothy would be able to join him so that they could then visit other believers together. So how does a believer show hospitality to fellow saints who are suffering for the Lord in these particular ways? Well, he visits them wherever they've been taken. 24, most blessed of women is jail. Really is. The wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. He asked for water and she gave him milk. In a magnificent bowl she brought him curds. I always thought that was kind of an interesting detail, you know, that it was in a magnificent bowl that she brought him. Well, whatever. She reached out her hand for the for these people, truth and love were in harmony. You know, you might not think that what is really important to you in life is obvious to other people. Okay, I'm going to tell you, it is. It is. People know what's important to you. People know. Many people in truth look like in the face of error. What is my response to be when one comes purporting to be bringing truth, but it's what's being said is not in line with the commands that we find in God's Word? That will be our subject for next Lord's Day, Lord willing. Charlie will now come forward. And tent peg, and a right hand for the workman's hammer. Then she struck Sisera. She smashed his head. Okay, is that a good song? She smashed his head. I don't know what exactly the tune would be for such a phrase, but maybe a little rap is really the best way to get across that kind of violence. I'm not sure. She shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay. Between her feet he bowed, he fell. Well, not she did specifically. Perhaps the strongest argument for approving of Jael's actions, saying the deception here was okay, is the one regarding God's commandment to exterminate the Canaanites. The Jews had not done this, and they were reaping the consequence. Jael could be seen as simply doing, you know, what she needed to do to fulfill God's expressed will. The advantage of this line of thinking is that it allows us to approve of what Jael did without leaving any room for application for today. You know, we would not imitate this now because we're not attached to a nation that has been asked to wipe out their nation. So you can kind of, you know, have your cake and eat it too if you take that kind of a view. But many commentators see no exception here. They think that the deceptions of Jael were wrong, though God still used them for good. They would say that deception is always evil, period. I have great sympathy for that position. Great sympathy for that position. And that is one that I think could be amply supported from the Old and New Testaments. So think about it. Can you be doing that? I'm seeing that as something that Jesus wouldn't do. So again, I'm inclined toward that was a wrong way to go about gaining this result. What I am really sure of is that we ought not to think because of this passage that we should be practicing deception. I really don't want that to be the lesson that you get out of this. Oh, okay. God can think it's really cool if you deceive and betray a trust if, in your mind, there's, you know, something really good to be gained out of that. We don't base our behavior based on what we think the result might be. We base it on what God's told us that we're supposed to do. We don't tell people lies to make them feel good. Okay? In the world, that's gospel. If you can make other people feel good about themselves or whatever, oh, you look incredible today. They don't, but you're giving them, you know, greater self-esteem or whatever by saying it. It's not